Well, we hope that you're enjoying the conference so far. Today, I'd like to present to you Robin Jahnstorm, and he's going to be talking about the five ways that UX of your toolset improves the quality of your games. It's super important. Your workflow is super important, yeah?
That's definitely right. Definitely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, take it away. I'll bounce out of here, and I'll put your presentation up. Go for it.
Awesome. Thank you very much. All right, so hi. Yes, I'm Robin Jahnstorm, and this is the five ways the UX of your toolset improves the quality of your games. So first of all, who am I? Who's this guy who's talking to you? Well, I used to work at Indie Studios on games for console and PC. Way back in the day, we're talking like 2009 is when I first professionally got started. I was then a co-founder of an indie studio for a little bit of time. I then did freelancing consulting as a tool designer for a little bit. Then I worked in the AAA industry at IO Interactive, who made the Hitman games on the Glacier 2 engine and editor. I then worked at Guerrilla Games on the Decima engine and editor. And then I spent a few years at Apple as a tool designer. Now, I'm back to being a workflow consultant and freelance tool designer. So, what five ways? Well, I'm going to tell you some stories of how tool UX design can improve your games. And those five are the power of asking why, the critical flaw of answer browsers, the power of spatial documentation, the interconnected nature of narrative tools, and the key UX differences between Unity and Unreal. So let's start off with the power of asking why. So in a job of tool UX design, you will get usually overwhelmed with feature requests like Jira tickets, emails, messages. Like folks will come to you with all kinds of things that they need to get done. And you need to like filter that down to what your team really needs, right? You need to understand like what are they requesting and why. And to discuss that, we first have to discuss Star Trek. Please state the nature of your medical emergency. If you've watched Star Trek Voyager, then you will know Robert Picardo playing the Doctor, who's a physical hologram in the medical bay. Whenever he is activated, he will ask those in the room what the nature of the medical emergency is, and then those in the room will state what they think is wrong with the patient, who's usually unresponsive. It is then on the Doctor to find out what the actual issue is. So, you know, if the people in the room were to say it's a heart attack, then the doctor would immediately believe them. He may end up performing completely the wrong procedure on the patient. Maybe they're having a heart attack, or maybe they're having a stroke. Both issues are related to blood flow, but, you know, one's related to the heart and the other to the brain. They're very different. Not that I know much about that. Damn it, I'm not a doctor. I'm a tool designer. But if the people in the room may not know exactly what the issue is, and the doctor still has to manually find out what is going on with the patient, well, in that case, you know, the answer they get may be wrong. You know, it does give a starting point on where to start looking. You know, a broken toe will be a different fact-finding method than trouble hearing. But this means that the question has to be asked, like, what's going on? You know, you have to still listen to what someone is saying, but then also confirm it and then dig in further. And the same goes for the job of tool UX designer. And this is why it's useful to keep asking why. For example, let's say that a user comes in and says that the translate gizmo needs to be yellow. Let's start asking why. So why do they need that? Well, it's because they're having trouble using it. Why is that? Well, it's because they have trouble seeing it. Why is that? Because there's too much stuff on top and it's covering gizmo. Why is that? Well, a lot of assets are covering it. Why is that? Oh, because the gizmo is rendered nearly last. At that point, we have assets being rendered all the way last, and so stuff can still cover that gizmo as it's being rendered on screen. Okay, so, you know, making the gizmo yellow would not have resolved the issue if we're trying to just make it yellow, right? Like, all those issues that we got through by asking why, we actually find out the real issue. If we would have just made it yellow, then maybe we would have caused, like, blue, red, green issues with the XYZ axes. Like, can you still see what is X, Y, and Z? Because those are usually blue, red, and green. And of course, it would have cost effort, right? Like that fix of that effort isn't nothing. It takes a little bit of effort, like engineering effort, you know, production effort to try and get something done. So, you know, what effort cost is there? There's the difficulty of doing it. There's the engineering time. And of course, we can try and find different ways of resolving it. Like maybe we render an outline around the gizmo. Maybe we do render it last. Or maybe, you know, the user shouldn't even have to click on the gizmo. Maybe they can click anywhere to move a particular object around. There's a lot of different other ways we can potentially solve this problem too. We don't have to do exactly what the user is asking every single time. So, you know, it also is important to find out where else would this be an issue. Like, are there lighting gizmos that have these issues? Are there animation helpers that have these issues, etc., right? Because then we want to make sure that those fixes are also applied there. We shouldn't just make the translate gizmo yellow, even though that's the initial ask. And of course, we want to find out, why was it made this way initially? Like, was it overlooked when it was first made this way? Was this done on purpose? Is there a really good reason it's not rendered last? Again, why? We have to keep asking why? Why is a particular thing going on? Why does it need to be fixed? You could do a lot of this work before bothering a single engineer, which is really, really important. You know, like, engineers are busy. Let's not interrupt them. They're busy enough as is. You know, find out why someone is requesting something first. Like, find out what is the real underlying issue that made them request that particular fix. And also, like, you know, some people might say, like, why would you even make it yellow? Like, who even asks something like that? Isn't it like kind of a strange ask? Sure, fine. Let's say it is. Let's grab a more realistic and complicated situation. Let's do that. So someone comes to you and says, hey, in the internal tool that we have, when you click the headers in the property panel, it should like expand and collapse to show more and less options. And they're also telling you that Unity and Unreal already do this. And they even show you a video of what that looks like. This is a really quality request. Like, there's a whole bunch of information. All right, let's take a look at that. So here we are in Unity. And we click the little header and the options expand and collapse. Okay, yeah, that kind of makes sense. You know, they're dealing with a lot of options. They want to expand and collapse these options so they don't have everything visible in one go. Unity and Unreal both do this. All right, that makes sense. Should we still do this? Let's implement it right away. Nope. Let's dig down and ask why. Well, it's because they can't find the properties fast enough because there's a lot of properties. Because they're too far down in the panel. You know, like, the objects have so many properties that it's like a giant list. And why is that? Well, it's because gameplay engineering is still iterating on what needs to be exposed and what not. You know, we're early on in the project, so a lot's still going on. What's happening? So now every option is exposed while they are testing and trying things out and seeing how gameplay should work. Okay, great. So what solutions can we think of here? Well, we can reorganize what properties are where. Maybe we can just, you know, make important properties higher up. Maybe we implement a search filter and you search by name for the particular thing that you want and maybe it pops up. Or maybe we literally implement the request as is. We could do that. But there's one other thing that we could do. And that is nothing. Because in the end, gameplay tech will catch up and those properties will disappear over time. Like, yes, there's a lot of properties right now, but gameplay tech will catch up. Not everything will be exposed in the future. And at that point, those property panels might be small enough that it's easy to find everything. And so, you know, maybe they will split those things up into multiple objects. So there's multiple objects, each with smaller property panels. Maybe the properties will be hidden later by the gameplay team. But, and maybe, there's always a chance, maybe we do really have to resolve this later. Maybe it's really important to do that in the future. That could be the case. But do we really, critically, have to do this right now? That's a really important thing to take a look at. Like, yeah, the request makes sense. Other editors do this. But do you have to do this right now? Is there not more important stuff to focus on? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But you need to keep asking why to figure that out and to really understand whether it's this thing that you need to do right now. So yes, write it down, let it sit, you know, mention it, you know, to a producer, for example, so others can catch it if it, you know, can catch it too, if it happens again, you know, see if it comes up again. Like, there's a bunch more people coming to you kind of going like, hey, we really need to, you know, make this expandable and collapsible in the property editor. Then, hey, at some point, yes, it is important enough to do it right now to unblock people or make it easier to work with. Sure. But like, you know, you can write that down and let it sit when you get that initial request, if it's deemed not as important, by going through all those whys. You know, every issue is real to the user. They're not going to come to you and just like frivolously ask for stuff. They need it for some reason. You know, like, their opinion needs to be remembered. The idea of how to solve it has to be noted. You don't have to do exactly what they say right away. Like, just like the doctor in Star Trek Voyager, you have to ask. You don't have to believe this all to the story. Like, trust and verify. Because they're having issues, right? Like, everyone has deadlines. They need to get things done, no matter who it is. So if someone wrote a ticket for you and like they need something, they really do need help. But in what way do they need help? And that's really the important thing to figure out. Like, in what way do they need help right now? So in conclusion, you know, treat every request with respect, kindness, and an open ear. And always keep asking, why? Because in that case, you can do the work that is really necessary right now and not spend it on things that may not be necessary at all. And that gives you more time to work on the things that you really need to improve your game. Super important. All right, let's go on to the next chapter, the critical flaw of asset browsers. So, you know, every project needs to browse assets, whether it's in 2D or 3D, you need to find what you're looking for. And, you know, some software, some DCCs, some digital content creation tools, they have those in editor. Other people use Windows Explorer, others use macOS Finder. In this particular case, for this chapter, I'm going to focus on integrated in-editor asset browsers. All right, so what is that critical flaw? Names. Relying only on names for asset search will get you in trouble over the long run. And let me show you how. So no naming convention pleases everyone, right? Like, it's impossible to make a naming convention that everyone is happy with. And of course, it also needs to be legible to humans, like everyone needs to understand it, but it also needs to fit the technical needs of the pipeline. So you kind of need to do everything all at the same time. You know, let's go through a couple of these things that usually pop up. Like, you know, what do we name this particular thing? Well, does it please every single part of the pipeline? Like outsourcing, artists, tools, import-export, the engine, is every single bit happy with that kind of naming? Do we use underscores like wood_door_broken? Or do we use dashes like wood door broken? But what about if that door splinters and we have a bunch of splinters? Like, is it now wood door broken splinter? Do we attach that to that asset? What about multiple splinters? Does it now become wood door broken splinter one? Like, do we start numbering things? But like, if we name them with numbers, do we start at zero or do we start at one? You can talk for hours and hours and hours about this question, whether it's zero or one. I've seen it happen. Don't do that, right? Like, it shouldn't even be a conversation. Also, like, how many modifiers of names are allowed? Like, can you abbreviate like wood door brute split T1? Like, is that okay or not okay? So many questions you can ask about naming conventions. Now, also, like, what if it's a texture, audio, or SFX file and not a 3D model? Also, are they organized by use or are they organized by like different ways? Like, are they organized by material? Like, for example, do we say wood door? Or do we say door wood? Like, which way do we go? There's so many more conversations and questions you can have about this. Like, let's, for example, look at this example from the Unreal Content examples. There's this barrel, and this barrel can explode. And if we look for barrel in the asset browser, we find all these splinters for the barrel. But the question is like, is that useful for the user to find? Like, let's be honest, like 99% of the cases, do they need to find all these splinters or do they just need to find the barrel and then place that barrel, right? So like, if we're searching by name, we're going to get stuck quite easily and quickly. Now, you know, this is not only the case for 3D editors, of course. Like, let's be honest, when you buy something online, you will have noticed this issue as well. I, for example, in the past online have bought a thing that was called pitch black solid thermal insulated grommet blackout curtains drapes for bedroom window, two panels, 42 inches wide by 63 inches long, black. That was the whole name of the particular thing I bought online. Of course, it's not a description anymore. It's just a description. It's no longer a name. Like, it's not a name. We're just like putting a whole bunch of description in the name to try and make sure that people can find it if they search for it enough. Like, you know, the system forces them to do that. Just like asset browsers do, you're going to keep adding more and more keywords to particular assets just to be able to make sure that you can find that particular thing that pops up in enough searches. Like, it makes sense that it's done that way, but of course, let's be honest, it's a bit ridiculous. Like, that's the name of a particular thing. That doesn't work well. Also, like, folks only remember a limited amount of names. Like, if you have 10,000 or more assets, how do you remember every single one of them? Like, let's be honest, you're not. You know, and also, what if someone needs to find something that they saw before? Let's say someone was flying through a level and they see this big like iron door somewhere and they're like, awesome, I want to use that in my level. So they go through the asset browser and they look for iron door and they get no results. That's weird. So what's happening is, okay, so they search for steel door, no results. Like, okay, so how do I find this thing? They type metal door. Ah, there it is. Like, what really is the difference between an iron door, a steel door, and a metal door? Like, really, when you look at it, like, can someone tell that just by looking at it? Like, do you really know what the difference is between those things? They're going to look very similar. Like, what really is the difference between iron and metal? Like, do we use scientific nomenclature instead? What if your team is bilingual? Like, what if you speak English, French, Spanish? in that case, like, what, you know, what do you call things so that everyone understands? And what if your team is made up out of a diverse group of people from all over the world? What if you have satellite studios? So the important thing to remember here is that someone looking for the metal door types in iron door, they're not wrong, right? It makes sense that you would type that in to find it. It's not an unrealistic train of thought. They're not wrong for doing it. It's not a user problem. It's a tools problem. So, you know, what do you do in a physical space? Like, imagine yourself at the supermarket, right? What do you do when you go to the supermarket? Do you know all the exact names of all the exact items you need whenever you enter the store? Or do you go to, like, the bread section and you find bread? Like, do you visually recognize what you need? That's probably the thing you do more often, right? Like, there's some names you remember, but most of the time you're looking around until you spot something, you grab it, and then you read it, right? But it's much more visual-based than exactly name-based. Like, your users will also stick to only using the assets they know if you're only using names, right? So many, like, very interesting and expensive and neat assets out there might not be used. Why? Well, they can't remember all the names. But the player sees the same 50 assets repeated constantly, right? Like, they're going through the game and they see the same 50 assets. They're like, damn, this looks kind of boring. It's because, you know, people can't find any other assets than those ones. Like, those are the ones they remember the names of, so they're going to keep on using those ones. It's not a tooling issue. It's a user issue. Like, imagine spending, like, millions on awesome outsourced art assets, but they're not used often. Not because they're not great. Not because, you know, they're not, like, performant. It's because people can't find them in the asset browser. It's a classical issue that happen a bunch. So, of course, you should have a naming convention. I'm not saying you should have none. And you should have a folder structure, totally. And files need to be saved somewhere, definitely. They should happen. But you shouldn't have hour-long meetings about naming conventions because you're trying to solve the wrong problem if you do that. You're trying to solve a problem that cannot be solved. There's not an ultimate naming convention that's going to do everything you need. And the way to get around this is by not searching by name. Just name it whatever works for the pipeline, but then instead use something else, such as collections, where any asset can be part of multiple groups. So let's open up Unreal. I have this neat collection system here in the bottom left. Click on that, you make a new local collection, and we name it something. Make another one, and we make another one. Let me organize those underneath the one that's there. Now let me look for some assets the classical way, and I'm just going to drag those in that collection. The shapes go over there, and I want to find some furniture. Let me grab some furniture assets, multi-select those, and then drag it in the furniture collection. Great. So now if I look for one collection, I see the things in there. Another collection, I see those in there. What I can also do is I can create another collection, another new one, call it, you know, my other collection. What I can do now as a separate collection, just grab a bunch of the assets I already had and drag them in there. So now I can find those assets in this collection, but also in this one, and also in this one, depending on which ones I put in where. Like, I'm not changing which folder they're saved. I'm not moving them around the disk. I'm just finding them in different ways inside the editor. Nothing on the file side is happening there, right? And that's very important. I mean, I could share these collections with other people. That's possible. But I'm not doing, like, irreversible changes that are going to break referencing. So let an art director decide what goes in which collections. Like, oh, for level one, we want these assets used. For level two, we want these assets used. Instead of having to look through all the assets available, right? And in that case, you always know what needs to be used where. You do not have to remember all the names of all the assets constantly, just like the ones that have been assigned for this particular area so that all those awesome assets can be used. Another great thing that you can combine with collections is zoos. I really love zoos. You can find assets like you're visiting the zoo. Let's take a look at an example from Counter-Strike Global Offensive. So in this case, what a zoo is we just have this level with all the assets of a particular level inside it. So in this case, this is for the nuke level. As we see, there's the ladders there, and I can just look at them right away. I can see how big they are, you know, relative to other things. There's the wires and cables. I see, like, there's all the LODs. There's the high and the low poly ones. Great. I can look at them. And I can just, you know, click on one of these and copy and paste it into the level. Look at how many, like, little tiny little bits and pieces there are in these wires. I don't need to remember all their names. Look around the level, look around the zoo. Can I go, what do I want to grab? Like, is that car a sedan or not? Can I find it when I search for sedan? doesn't matter. Fly around, click on it, copy paste it over. Look at all these little vent parts. Do I really need to remember all their names and make sure I don't forget any of them? Like, does everyone constantly need to name all these things entirely super correctly? Otherwise, you can't find anything. All these boxes, I'll just copy and paste them over. Don't care what they're called. Doesn't matter. And you can do that not just with models, but also materials, for example. Like, look at this material section. I don't even need to know what these colors are called. Is it red or is it like some other kind of red with a different name? Doesn't matter. I look at it, look around, which one do I want to grab, copy and paste it over to the level that I'm using, right? Super, super much more useful. No need for names. And here's another asset zoo. In this case, also for Counter-Strike Global Offensive, but for a Mayan type level. Look at all this stuff. You can just fly around and look at what you need. No need to remember names. No need to like try and find the particular thing by just constantly like searching through folders and folders of stuff. Just fly around until you spot it. And at some point, you're going to know where these things are located in space, which is, in a lot of cases, much easier to find than just having to go through folder structures. Look at all these tiny little bits and pieces. No need to remember any of their names. So much more nicer and useful. You can even make these little vignettes of like, oh, these are like setups of this is how you put these assets together to create like a nice sort of like vignette of what this thing would look like. And a bunch of games do this, but it's usually not as public. For example, a few years ago, Overwatch released a video of them making a new map. And hey, for a few seconds, I paused the video and took a screenshot of this is a zoo from Overwatch, right? Like you see a whole bunch of assets and you can see what's being used, right? It's a much more nicer way of finding assets. So no need to remember any of their names. You look around, you find what you need. You see the scale right away. You know when sometimes you pull in an asset and it's like huge, you're like, oh, dang it, I didn't need that. You can see it right away in the zoo. No need to first open it up. It's right there. You can also see the LODs right away. You can also include materials, shaders, textures, VFX. Like let's say, for example, you have some fire VFX and some water VFX. You don't need to open every single one individually in editors. Look at them all right away in one go and just kind of go, oh, I kind of like that one, and then grab it. You can even include mobs, NPCs, bosses, mechanic, all kinds of stuff. We're going to go through an example of that later. And we see the assets also in proper lighting. Now in an asset browser, you usually just have some kind of default void it's in. You pull it in and suddenly it looks really weird in lighting. With a zoo, not that problem. You can even automate zoo creation, right? Like make it auto-populate all these assets so you don't have to manually put them down. And again, combine collections and zoos to make it super easy to find what you need. For example, here's another example from the Unreal content examples. And like just a bunch of sections about particular things. In this case, it's for cloth physics. So in this particular case, there's a bunch of things here. You can even use this, for example, like for smoke testing, right? Like, does it still work every day? Press play and boom, we see how these things work. We just walk around, look at them. Does all this work correctly? Which features do I want to use? Imagine with this with like NPCs or bosses, you know, they can just try a thing out, see if it works all in this one like little zoo area. And same goes for the physics one that they have for chaos destruction. Like, look at how big this one is. Look at all these examples, all in one place. Just look around, fly around, walk around, and you can find what you need. No need to remember any other names. Fly around, and you can find them. So pick a naming convention and stick to it. Definitely, you need a naming convention. Pick one. But don't think about it too much. Don't have, like, if you're having hour-long meetings about naming conventions, you're doing it wrong. Stop doing that. You're wasting time, essentially. Like, don't look for assets by name. If you're doing that, you're in a world of hurt. Don't look for assets by name. So in conclusion, think back to the human being, right? Like think back of like how human beings think about stuff. Think about yourself in the supermarket and finding things. And think about how your tools affect your final product, right? Like in this case, if we have those amazing assets, but they're never being used, it's not a user issue, not even an art direction issue. It's a tools issue. They can't find the right assets. So let's move on to chapter 3, the power of spatial documentation. So when you're building any project, especially 3D projects, communicating internally about what needs to be built is super important. Like what should go where and why. And documentation is usually used to bridge that gap, right? Of like what needs to go where, send people documentation. However, how do you do that? Like Confluence, Trello, Basecamp, Jira, Slack, Google Docs, Excel, there's a million ways to do it. Also, if you're documenting through text, you know, there's images, videos, graphs, etc. The problem is those are all not where the actual work happens. Like you're building the product in like Unity, Unreal, Maya, Blender, Godot, 3ds Max, Houdini. You're not building it in Confluence and Trello. So you constantly have to switch between those tools. And switching between those tools, there's like a mental fatigue of constantly having to switch between them. Also, now you need a pipeline for changes to roll through. Like if someone now changes something in game, you have to remember, oh, I got to go to this Confluence page and make the change over there because otherwise they're not in sync anymore. And I constantly got to remember to go back and forth. It's not great, right? And also, bad search functions make this incredibly difficult. Like if I have to look for, you know, a particular page on Confluence, usually that's very difficult, right? I have to remember the exact name. Same issue that we just talked about. I have to remember all these names. Very difficult for folks. So the solution here is to have the documentation in the same spatial place as the content. Let's again look at the Unreal content examples of a great way of doing this. So here we have this zoo again, this little, I think they call them museums in their case. So looking over here, great. And there's this little green arrow. It's in space, and I click on that. And in its properties, there's a link, and that opens up the documentation page. So I don't need to remember what this documentation page is called or where it's located. I go in-game, I find a thing, what's there, and click on it, and that takes me to the right place. So this is a fantastic way to work. There's no need for me to Google stuff, no need to guess the name of the documentation, no relying on bad search functionality. And let's be honest, Google is also very much falling behind on that now, right? Like you gotta add Reddit to every search sometimes, like to find the right thing. It's not great. Like if you're relying on that, it's going to be difficult to find what you need. If you just place that, you know, the green question mark somewhere, place those around places where documentation is relevant, much easier to find that there even is documentation. It's also protected from iteration, right? Like if a piece of content moves and there was like a green, you know, question mark attached to it, then that will move with the content, right? Like we should save that together as a group and make sure it moves with it. That also means that the page name in Confluence or Trello or whatever can now change anytime without worry. Like, and what mirror board is this? Just rename it because there should be a link to the mirror board. You shouldn't have to search for the mirror board. So you remove a lot of like long-term issues with spatial documentation. Like people can't find stuff, things are miscommunicated, there are issues with the game. You resolve all of this by using spatial documentation. And it does not even have to be external documentation. Like since the 90s, editors have had spatial objects for documentation. For example, the source engine, entities for lighting, fog, and color correction are in a central location. For example, let's take a look at here in Dust 2, an ancient map by video game standards. So I'm right next to a bomb site in this case in the level. So one of the more central locations of the map, or at least an important location of the map. And there are some entities in there that govern the things that I need. I don't need to go with like a property panel, a bunch of tabs, go through a bunch of stuff and try to find out what I need to do. I can find it all right here, the important stuff I need, and then click on it and there's the properties I need. Same goes for this other level called Nuke. Bunch of stuff right there in a central-ish location of the map, and I can find them just by flying around. I see what I need. So the spatial information of where you would expect it to be is really important. Like, oh, the thing that I need is where I think I would need it. And of course, you know, for example, you would save this in a debug layer so players don't see it, right? But the developers would see it. A really great way of thinking about this as well is, let's say that we're, you know, early in development and there's a big world map, but like what is where? Do you go into Confluence and constantly have to like check some 2D map that people forget to update? Let's be honest, happens all the time. Forget to update the 2D map and now you're looking at a game and it doesn't match up and it's difficult to understand. What if instead you put that text right into the level? Here's the farmlands, dungeon number one's over there, dungeon number two's over there, great. We have the human city over there, some dwarven caves over there, deep forest over there, great. So I can just fly around and see what I need. Players won't see this, right? Like when gameplay starts, this text will hide. But as a developer, you're just going to look through this and see what's going on. We can even see like, oh, a quest 3 start location's over there. So now I understand like, hey, there's a thing here, you know, that's important for a particular thing that someone else might need or I might need depending on what I'm doing. It's much easier to think about the world in this way. Now, yes, we could instead require everyone to be incredibly meticulous all the time. Like pay attention to all the meetings and all the emails you get and every single change that comes through. But what if someone is sick or on vacation? You know how like, people go on vacation and they come back and they're immediately stressed out because there's so much stuff they suddenly have to account for? What if instead it's like in-game, in the editor, you just look at it and kind of go, oh, I see everything that's changed and what's happened. Like, make workflows that easily resolve these problems. Think of the human being. What would a human being do in these cases? Because we're not perfect. Don't try and make human beings perfect. It's not going to work out. We all have issues here and there. Try and work with people. Try and figure out what can we do to resolve these issues when they pop up. Because it's when not if. This also goes for like smaller locations, right? Like what if a city isn't built yet, but will be built? Why not use spatial documentation instead? For example, look at this. There's an armor shop over there, a guard post over there, and a cinematic number two is over there. Oh, and do not move. Great. I know. I look at it, I go, cinematic number two, don't move. Cool. I'm not going to move it. I'm not going to touch it because that might break something, right? Calls a lot of like QA time, a lot of production time trying to resolve that. Now, maybe I got an email that says like, don't move cinematic 2_3B_V2. But like, who's going to read those? Like, yes, you should. You should. But like, let's be honest, who actually like reads all of those emails all the time and remembers all their names? Much more difficult. Showed a thing in game. Don't move. Great. Got it. Understand it. Much easier to understand for human beings. So again, we're going to go back. Think about yourself at the supermarket. You simply look around, you grab, and you read. You don't have to remember every single thing all the time. You might make a list for yourself of stuff you want, but do you write down like the exact perfect names every single time? Probably not. It's just like butter, bread, great, and you find whatever butter or bread is there that you recognize or like. So get the information needed in the blink of an eye. That's the important thing about spatial work. And also keep users in their flow of work, right? Again, about that 2D map I mentioned, that should be super simple to work with, right? Like you can also do that in Editor. Here's a top view of that same level I just showed. Great. And this isn't like new stuff, right? Like if you have a node editor, or especially if you worked with Blueprint, you've already done this before like this. Like there's little comment nodes that you can do, like comment sections you can do around nodes. Like for example, I can see like, hey, viewport UI is there, set vehicles there, update speeds there, and update gears there. Great. Imagine I have to look at this and without the comments. How about I know what's happening there? I have to understand, I have to read everything, understand what's going on. It takes so much more time and effort. Put some comments in there. Cool. I need to adjust a gear thing. Great. I know exactly where to go. Same also goes for Photoshop. There's a really cool like tutorial system they have now where you hover over something and you can see a little GIF that explains how it works or what it's supposed to do. No link to immediately a link to documentation that's like pages long with all kinds of technical detail. Just how does this thing work? Great. I now understand what this thing can do. Much simpler to understand. So, you know, most users won't read documentation. Should we? Yes, but we're human. Most of the time we don't. They'll watch a GIF though. They'll watch like a 2-minute GIF, totally. Not much longer than that. Like, you know how when you open up a video and the timeline's 30 minutes and you're like, I'll watch that later. You put it in the tab somewhere. Now you have 100 tabs open. Let's be honest. We've all done that at one point in time. Like just open up videos, we'll watch it later and we never do. It's human, right? If we make it nice and short, quick explanation, much easier to understand. Now, I need to call out that the exception here is programmers. Programmers, especially when they're working with API, they love text. They love reading like text and text and text, a lot of technical detail. Awesome. Yeah, great. Do it for them if they need it. Absolutely. There's a lot of cases where they love that. But when you're doing like spatial documentation, don't just put a browser in your editor. Now you just have like another window open, but somewhere in your editor instead of in like Chrome or Firefox or Safari. That doesn't resolve the problem. You just moved the problem. You haven't resolved it. Another great example is like Peter Fester, your friend group, did a presentation about Battlefield 1 and, for example, about the heat map stuff they did. And you can see the heat map in 3D in the level. Isn't that awesome? Like you understand where your players are dying or where they're using certain weapons and stuff like that. Like that's you working contextually in the space. You understand it relative to the space you're working in. It's spatial. Another great example of this is ghosting. So it's a very useful tool for your editor because it prevents any clipping issues from being found too late. You know how when like a door opens and it clips into something and an NPC gets stuck, or even worse, the player gets stuck and now you got to do a whole bunch of QA tickets and try to resolve a whole bunch of stuff. What if instead, the moment you place anything that is animated, there's a little ghosting there that shows you like, hey, this thing's going to open up to here. It's a great tweet from Joe Wintergreen. Highly recommend following him where, you know, you just see where that thing's going to go the moment you place it. You understand exactly what it's going to do. No bunch of QA tickets or a bunch of people getting stuck. Like, you know exactly when you place it, this is going to be fine. Or not fine, and you move it slightly, and then it is fine. So, conclusions. Again, think of the real-life equivalent. How do people, like, really work with spaces? And think back to the human being. Like, how would human beings work with these things? If you constantly have to switch between all these documents and all these things, it's going to be confusing. If the information you need is right there, much more simple to work with. Next, the internet-connected nature of narrative tools. So, it's a lot involved with narrative content tools. So much stuff. Like, You need to write dialogue. You need to set dialogue choices. What characters say which lines. Values for the triggers of specific lines. Choices during conversations. The active quests involved. Quest states. Where characters are located. Audio files for each line. Animation for each line. Quest items. Relationship levels, because it depends on which choices you can make. Currently equipped items, because those might affect the dialogue. The character health might affect it too. Is there some character spells you could have cast? There's terrain around the conversation. We got to make sure nobody gets stuck. Also, there's crowds and NPCs around the conversation. Make sure none of them walk through it. There's also cinematics that might happen depending on which conversation thing you take. And there's so much stuff to do with narrative tools. It's very easy to scope creep, right? These things. But at the same time, many of these things I mentioned will be considered plain base level features. Like, you need to do this to make sure the narrative tools are good. And so important to think about this is that narrative is interconnected. Narrative content touches everything else. Don't forget that when you're working with narrative tools. So in this case, like, don't think per tool, think per workflow. So let's say that we have a geometry tool, shader graph, a scripting tool, terrain tool, lighting tools, a dialogue tool, all different tools, right? They're differently worked on and separately built. It's not how workflow works. Workflow interconnects them. There's, for example, the combat workflow over here. There's the narrative workflow over here. There's cinematics workflow over here. And they use these various tools together. It's not separate tools. It's tools used together to make stuff. You know, also, every writer has their own technique. Some really love script writing, like official, you know, scripts as they do in Hollywood. Others love using LaTeX. I know it says LaTeX, but it's pronounced LaTeX. And if you say LaTeX to someone using LaTeX, they're going to immediately correct you. So here I am saving you. The next time you see LaTeX, pronounce it LaTeX. Otherwise, they're going to correct you. LaTeX. Anyway, it's a specific language that some writers use to do really good writing. It makes them happy writing, right? So every writer is unique. You know, like, find out how they like to write. It's really important to find out, like, what they do. Again, keep asking why. And please, don't just give them a note editor and tell them they can do anything. You might as well tell your engineers, here's assembly code. You can technically do anything. You're technically correct, but that's much harder to work with, right? Like, we're going to give them an IDE. We're going to give them, like, C or C++ or maybe even, you know, higher level languages and make it much easier for them to work, right? So why would you not also do that for other developers? Like, don't just give them a note editor and tell them, oh, you can do anything. Not everyone can work in a note editor. Note editor is still scripting. It's still doing some programming. And sometimes the best writing software is a third-party app, right? Like, even if the import-export is lossy, it may still be better to use a third-party app. And the reason for that is this. So I will ask you, what is less effort? Narrative folks learning to be technical or your engineers solving a technical problem? Like, your engineers are set up to solve technical problems. Let them solve the technical import-export problem. Don't just go like, hey, narrative folks, you're all supposed to be technical now. That's a much harder ask, right? Not an impossible one. Definitely folks that can do it. But, like, think about what is less effort in this case. Like, what can give you better results? So keep talking to your users. Find out what they need. Like, figure out what they need and when they need it. And also, give your writers a scratch pad. Like comments in the note editor. We just showed that, right? You can just place a comment and it doesn't touch anything. It's quite often that I see note editors or narrative tools where if you just make a separate note somewhere and just do a little scratch pad, a little just like, what about this? And immediately warnings pop up and errors. And it's like, oh, there's a separate note and you can't run this and you can't press play anymore. And it's terrifying. It's not great to work with. Like, just allow them to just put their thoughts down without breaking anything. Just like have something separate without it immediately warning them. Right, like allow for empty nodes, allow for disconnected dialogue trees. Yes, that dialogue will now not be used, but it also doesn't warn them right away. Just allow them, you know, to just work. Like, the creative processes are not structured. You often don't know where you will end up. You're like, oh, maybe it's going this direction, maybe like this. But you want to allow for that creativity for your game to feel awesome and to feel creative and to feel unique, right? You don't just want to have it super structured all the time. And also, like, what if a change happens? Like, let's say there's a burning building in the game, and it's being changed to a flooding building. Why is that happening? Well, effects came to gameplay, and they were like, hey, the burning VFX is really difficult to do. Flames are difficult. Can we flood the building instead? And gameplay was like, yeah, I mean, the building's being destroyed one way or another, so we don't care. They high five. Everyone's happy. How will narrative know they need to make a change? Because the characters are still going to be talking about, like, oh, my God, it's on fire, while they're drowning. Right? That happens a lot during development, right? These are classical issues. that a simplistic solution here is more meetings, more mails, and more Slack messages. Let's just throw everyone to death with more meetings that they have to be informed all the time, everywhere, constantly. Sucks. Ugh. What's much more human? Organize folks to smaller strike teams with more focus and less overall meetings. They might meet more with each other, but less with all these other things that they don't need to worry about. Because otherwise, everyone's going to be constantly informed about everything. That's not human. You're not going to be able to do that all the time. So, you know, let the team create context as they play through and see what is necessary inside the editor in game, spatially, instead of in some separate app. You know, allow these human beings to work. You know, narrative is not siloed. You know, it affects design, art, cinematic, VFX, tools all over the place. So it's really important to keep remembering that. So, moving on to the conclusions, let writers work the way they want to work. Like, learn how they work and try to figure out, can we do it in that way? And let writers just write. Don't constantly, like, hamstring them with, like, oh, you got to do it this way or this particular way. That's not creative. You're going to limit them. And narrative is interconnected to everything else in your game. It's going to touch everything else. So make sure that you know that and that the tools are set up to allow for that. Next, last chapter, the key UX differences between Unity and Unreal. And that's a pun, because I'm talking about the hotkeys of Unity and Unreal. So first, let's talk about Unity. This is the hotkey editing interface of Unity. Look at that. We got a keyboard, instantly understand what it looks like. Yep, that's a keyboard, got it. We can hover over a section here. In this case, I'm hovering over F6, and I see it's a terrain detail brush. Great. I see a bunch of colors, and it's like, oh, it's an assigned key, and there's a global key. Got it. I understand right away what's being used where and what new keys I could use if I need to make a new hotkey. It's a little search panel as well, and I can go through a list of items there. Cool. Got it. I might search for shift and not get results for like what functions are using shift. It's a bit of a shame. But generally, look at this. Cool. Makes sense. All right. Like, it's clear color, clean visual, easy to understand. You understand what things are and what keys they use right away. Could it be prettier? Of course, everything could always be prettier, but makes sense. You get it. Cool. Now, if you now hold shift, it shows you which keys are using shift. So I can do, for example, shift 2, shift D, shift F. So I can see what keys are now changing depending on which modifiers I have pressed. You know, it lights up differently. And when I now hit control, same thing happens. I can see what's being used and where. If I use shift control, I can press these buttons to change something. Super clear and easy. Understand it right away what's going on. Also, if I create a binding conflict, like, you know, for example, I'm flying and I want to change it to like a different key. I use W, for example, and it says like, hey, W is already assigned in the viewport. Do you want to reassign or do you want to create a conflict? What do you want to do? Let's say I want to create a conflict. Little yellow exclamation mark kind of go like, hey, warning, watch out. Like, there's these things are the same. Cool. Got it. Like, really clear. No, yellow, in this case, on like the dark interface, easy to see. Get it. Nice. Like, anyone can look at this and understand it right away, right? Now let's look at Unreal. Here is Unreal's hotkey editing interface. It's a big list. It's a really big list. We can look at the top right at the little scroll bar there. It's a big list. And it's not even everything. It doesn't actually show everything. There's even more that it cannot show. There's a lot of stuff. Just a lot of stuff. It's not easy to understand what's being used, where, why, or how. It's quite difficult. Also, there's a lot of options here. Like, for example, show texture resolution. There's texture 0, 1, 10, 100, 101, 102, 103, 104. There's a lot of textures that I could show on, you know, resolution. What about GPU? And I can make a separate binding for every single one of them. So apparently, I can make a function for every, I make a hotkey for every single function. There's 255 unique individual entries for these texture, show texture resolution functions. Is that super useful? Like, do I need to scroll through that and really find all that stuff? Probably not. It's neat. Got to hand them that. It's really neat that I'm able to, like, you know, make those changes and do all those things. And I've actually asked around, and there's someone in the VFX industry who actually does use this. So, like, it's not without use. I'll hand them that. It is, you know, useful in some cases, but it's a lot, right? It's difficult to see and overlook. Like, for example, if I search for shift, I don't find out which keys use shift. Can't find it. It's a bit of a shame. And let's say, for example, I want to change the fly key again, like the W key I talked about. I search for fly and I get the UV editor and I enable fly camera in there. But what about like just like in the 3D viewport when I fly? Can't find it when I look for fly. Remember the problem with the Acer browsers when we're searching for names and using names for search? This is the exact same problem. How do I know what that function is called to change the thing that I want to change? No idea. I can't find it easily, right? So it says search, look for controls, and I get different headers now that I haven't seen before when usually scrolling down. And then if I go through there, open one of these up, I find use WASD only when a mouse button is pressed, and it's for the flight camera control type. Great. Also, flight camera control type. So if I type fly, I don't find flight. That's problematic, right? It's, again, not unreasonable to search for fly and intending to look for flight, right? You can probably fuzzy search that so it's similar enough because, for example, in Unreal Blueprints, if you type if, you will find the branch statement because they don't call it if statements, they call them branch statements. So fuzzy search is possible. They haven't done it in this case, which I think is a bit of a shame because it makes it harder to find particular things. But yeah, I also, as far as I can tell, maybe someone else can correct me if they want to, I can't find where to change WASD. Where do I make that change to actually, change how I fly? As far as I know, I can't. So there's way more features to bind hotkeys to. So many features. As far as I know, every feature can have a separate hotkey. Awesome. It's much harder to find the hotkeys you want to change. So there's a lot of power here. There's a lot of raw power, but it's like having the power of the sun in the palm of your hand. You're just going to burn. It's great, but it's going to burn you up. Super powerful, not that great user experience-wise. And if, for example, I do create a conflict, for example, a thing here, there's now red text on a black background, and it's honestly a little bit hard to read even on my big screen here. It's I need to really sort of look in close. It's difficult to see, right? Just those little UX things, they happen a lot. It can affect your work, right? Now, if someone wants to change a hotkey so they want to work faster, it's going to be more difficult for them to do. And now they can't work as fast as they otherwise could. And now they're being hamstrung by the tool set, right? You can make tools super powerful, but if they're not easy to use, who cares, right? Same as with the Acer browser. We'll make we outsource millions of dollars of assets, but if nobody can find them, we're wasting that time and money. So someone might ask, does this even matter? Does it even matter that these hotkeys, in Unreal are harder to find? Well, it matters for accessibility, power users, and the user experience, right? If you have power users, they're going to want to do particular hotkeys for particular things. For accessibility, it's really important that people can set things in the way that they need to do. And for UX, it's just useful to make sure that the user is happy with the tool. Also, your games do it. Your games allow for easy setting of hotkeys, even for controllers. So why not your tools too? For example, here in Modern Warfare 2, this is a classical key binding list, right? There's a key binding list and you can change the keys. Yes, it's not the nice overview that Unity did. I think that'd be even better. A lot of controller mappings do have that. We have a little controller visual and you see little arrows pointing at each button. But the gamers can do this, right? Gamers will play these games for 70, 90, 100, 200, 300 hours. And, they'll have to change these things because they're pros, for example, right? They're having a really good time. Your developers are going to be using your tools for 8 or sadly more hours a day for 4, 5, 6 years on a AAA project. And they can't change the hotkeys easily? That's bad, right? We look at them and kind of go, that's not great. We should make sure that it's nice to change these things. If our end users can, why can't our developers? They're going to be spending more time in these tool sets. So should Unreal fix this? Well, of course, it always depends. How important is this to their users? I haven't forgotten. Keep asking why? And of course, do you really critically have to do this right now? Is there other more important stuff to please shareholders, for example? Then, maybe we have to wait with this. But you have to find out what can be fixed and what has to be fixed, right? You need to have those conversations with yourself and your team and your tools. So inclusions, comparing tools is fun. A fun thing to do, I highly recommend looking at various tools and comparing them. Power alone will not save your tools, right? If they're really super powerful, it's great, it's nice, but if you just keep making them more powerful, but they keep getting harder to use, at some point that's going to go wrong. We're seeing that happening a little bit in industry right now, right? When we're talking about Unity and Godot, where Godot just is a lot easier to use by a lot of people, they're switching from Unity to Godot instead. Stuff matters. It takes a lot of years to build up that, that the UX debt. And at some point, it might be too late. So as Unity, I really hope they're still putting a lot of effort into the UX of the tool set, because if you don't, they can be powerful. It doesn't always matter. It matters to a big degree, but it's not everything. And of course, if you give good UX to your players, why not also give it to your developers, right? Like, they're going to be spending a lot of time in these tool sets. Let them do it. So those are the five ways, right? We've gone through them. But what are the overall conclusions? Essentially, it's, you know, keep asking why. Always think back to the human being. Try to be close to your content at all times. Notice how many of your workflows are interconnected at all times. And improving the user experience of your toolset will make your games easier to make, and also because of that, better to make. It's no guarantee, but if you help your developers doing more work in less time and they're happier doing it, doesn't that sound helpful? Doesn't that sound great? Thank you very much. These are the sources that I used if you want to take a look at them. And that's it. Thank you very much. You can find more Tool UX design at my website over here, rystorm.com. Find me on Twitter, Mastodon, Blue Sky nowadays. And there's my LinkedIn QR code on the side. Are there any questions?
That is awesome. All right. I'm going to keep that up on screen for just another second. And then we've got a couple questions. The thing I love about UX, right? I love what you were talking about, how... Okay, I just removed that off the screen if you wanted to take that off so you can see.
Close it. Okay, great.
Oh, yeah. Got it. How, you know, it's like, it's for the end user. Why not for the people creating, right? That totally makes sense. And user experience, what's so awesome about that is it, you know, you think about user experience and you think computer video games, but it's not. There's real world user experience. Have you ever walked up to a door that has a handle on it and you go to pull it and it's a push only door? Like, yes. what is the point of that? Like, you know, or the ones that just have the rectangular piece of metal, you know, to push that, right? You know, that's what you're doing. I've walked up to doors so many times and went to pull them. I mean, maybe it's good for closing them from the outside or whatever, but man, it's just like, that's the user experience. You walk up to it and your brain just thinks to cha-ching. And I feel like it's that way a lot with,
the official nomenclature for that is the Norman door. It's like Don Norman talked about that in his book, The Design of Everyday Things. Talked about that. So like usually people in design call it the Norman door, because that's exactly it. It's like you want to push it and you get stuck. You want to pull it, you get stuck. And it's just like, it's not the right user experience for these things. It's really important to make sure that, you know, those things are easy to understand and easy to use.
Stupid UX hotel. That Chase says that door analogy happened to me at DICE.
DICE at Vegas? Casino. Well, that's funny. I do have to say there's one thing. I used to live in the U.S. I used to live in California. And one thing I did like about the U.S. is that because of fire safety code, every outside-facing door has to go outside so that people can rush out in case there's a fire. So at least in the U.S., just by fire code, every single outside door, you always know enters, like goes outside, no matter whether to push or pull. That's one thing I like, because at some point, like I would recognize that there would be a handle, but I really have to push it. And I'd recognize it just because it would go outside. Not perfect, but it's one thing I really like.
But you know, it's a step in the right direction, right? So you were talking about zoos, and zoos, like when you are in Fortnite Creative, that's what they have. They have zoos, basically. You're like, bam, and then all the assets are right there. And that's pretty awesome.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Let's hit them some questions. And if you guys have any more questions, is the inside
we'll see one from Force Games? I think it was like, can all teams please have the time and flexibility to ask why before we dive into implementation? Yeah, that's a great point. It's definitely the case. Is like, do I even get the time to look at this stuff? Do I even get the time to ask all these questions? And the big thing that I've been advocating for many, many years for now is hire a tool designer. Like, don't get your engineers to do all that legwork. They're busy. Don't ask the user who has requested the thing to look all this stuff up. They're busy with deadlines. Get a dedicated role, a tool UX designer on your team who literally has the time to figure all that stuff out, right? It's very much like hiring producers, where you hire a producer to handle a lot of stuff, right? Could an engineer or like an IC, like an artist, like make a bunch of stuff without a producer? They could, but let's be honest, in bigger teams, it's not going to be as efficient. Same with the tool designer. If you don't have a tool designer, you're going to be less efficient. So hire that person to do that job, and they have the flexibility to then dive into the implementation or dive into what is necessary for the implementation before anyone else, so that everyone else can just keep doing their work. They got deadlines.
So what size of team, programming team, do you think that it's the point to hire a UX designer? Tool designer.
I don't think in this case, this is a great question. I don't think in this case it matters on the tools team. It matters on the amount of users you have and how much time they're spending in the tools. Like, right. If you have like in this case, a very easy way to think about it is like, if you have like 50 people, like working 8 hours a day for like 5 years straight, and they constantly keep getting stuck, like, you know, every, you know, few minutes, then at some point you're gonna be like, we gotta resolve this issue, right? So it's looking at like, how many issues are they running into? How many times are they getting stuck? How many times are we wasting time, essentially? Hmm. And if you know that, then you know like, hey, how much time are these people wasting? How much money is that costing us? Like, are we having principals and like seniors being stuck because of tools? It's a lot of money going out the door where they're like not doing anything because they're stuck. Once that number reaches a certain point, hey, cool, you got the salary of a tool designer that will be cheaper to expense and hire that person and resolve these things for these people. So they're not wasting time and wasting money. So it's looking at that connection of like, how much time and money are we wasting on these expensive people versus how much would it cost to hire a tool designer? And then you know.
Right. But it's also about like not necessarily just getting stuck, but workflow, right? If there's a workflow that everyone is doing and it takes them 10 steps to do it, but someone could come in and design it to where it's only 2 steps, you know, that saves, you know, even if it's just like a minute or two. I mean, like you said, if you got a 50 people using that tool and they're wasting a minute or two every couple of hours over time, that's a lot of time. All right. So here we got another question.
Months and months.
Months and months.
Sorry, yes.
Another question from Forest Games here from YouTube. Do you happen to know any such tools to generate zoos or manipulate collections in Unity?
I don't have specific ones I can name, but they're like, because again, the difficulty here is like, what is this particular thing called? The easy thing to do in this case is to like look through the asset stores of like Unreal and Unity. It's kind of like look at who's doing those things. But also in a lot of cases, this is something that you could try and make internally. Because essentially what you're trying to do, right, is you grab the assets that exist. You grab, you know, the size that they are. You grab how many distance that needs to be in between them, either through the triangles or the physics mesh that they have. And you simply place them in a group. And you try and organize them through tags, right? Like depending on how your assets are built up, this can be an extremely easy task. So it's one of the things that you could potentially also do yourself. But sadly, I cannot give you the names of specific ones for Unity and Unreal that already do that.
Be a good thing to hit Google with, yeah?
Yeah, if you can find them. Exactly. Issue that I mentioned of like, can you find the name for these things? Because I call them zoos. I see Unreal call them museums sometimes. There's other engines editors which call them other things. There's not like a single nomenclature for it. I will forever keep using zoos because that's how I grew up with these things way back in the day. I'm going to keep using those, and maybe if I keep using it long enough, everyone else is going to use them. But there
everyone
sadly
is not calling them zoos.
Yeah, I hope so. I think that'd be great. But it's one of those things where it's like there's no official nomenclature that is like, you know, completely like game industry vetted of like, this is what we call this thing.
Right. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Ramanyan. So we are actually going to have an hour break, and then we have, it's a public, I forgot what it's called. We're going to have quite a few publishers come on, and they are going to share their pitch decks to you game developers about what they do. This is the first time we've ever done that. It's a publisher pitch, and it's going to be bam, bam, bam. It's going to be like speed dating. There'll be little Q&As. Going through there. So that is going to start in 1 hour. Lightning round publishers pitching to developers. So LRPPD, that's what it's called from now on. Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you as well for having me. Appreciate it. See you.